Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, where we get you all caught up on all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Anna Staper. Today, I'm being joined at the roundtable by Haley B. Miller, political reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Good morning, Haley.
Good morning.
Marty Schladen, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Happy Monday.
Good morning, Anna.
And Andrew Tobias, a longtime member of the roundtable who now has a new title, a state reporter for the nonprofit newsroom Signal. Welcome back.
It's good to be here.
And speaking of new things, you may have noticed the new music. All Sides has undergone a brand refresh. You can see the new logo and brand promise at our website, WOSU.org. Let's talk politics. Only 3 weeks are left until Election Day, and the two men running to be Ohio's next U.S. Senator have yet to debate. Both men say they're willing. Here's Bernie Moreno.
I've said for 8 months that we would debate him. Sherrod Brown, look, Sherrod Brown can't stand in a debate stage and debate me because he makes up lie after lie after lie after lie.
And here's Senator Sherrod Brown.
Most of these reporters have seen me debate every race I've ever run in. I still plan to debate if it gets to that. But I would like to debate and have always said that.
Haley, if they're both willing, why hasn't it happened?
So we don't know the nitty-gritty of the behind-the-scenes conversations of debate negotiations, but I know at least one organization, the Ohio Debate Commission, reached out to both campaigns. They acknowledged the request, but the Debate Commission never received a confirmation. No one ever agreed to do a debate. So I would guess that, you know, there are campaign strategists in both camps talking about, you know, the advantages and disadvantages of whether their candidates should go on the debate stage. We've seen campaigns in the past at the top of the ticket very recently, and even in Ohio, tussle over moderators, rules, fact-checking, stuff like that. So I feel like debate politics are kind of their own mess in itself.
Yeah, Marty, like she said, the Ohio Debate Commission extended an invitation. Moreno also challenged Brown to an impromptu debate to, like, come down to a TV station one day where he was. Didn't happen, but it was unclear whether Brown saw the invite in time to even get there. So could we scramble together a debate before Election Day?
I don't see any reason why not. I covered a debate during Brown's last election. So if they really both wanted to debate, there's no reason why they couldn't get in the same room in front of a TV camera and do that. I wonder, you know, the conventional wisdom is if you feel like you're pretty secure in your lead, you don't feel like you need to debate. All you're going to be doing is giving a bigger megaphone to your opponent to amplify their message. I don't know if that's Brown's thinking, though, right now.
Yeah, Andrew, that kind of brings me to my question. Is there any advantage to debating at this point for either of the candidates? I mean, it's within margin of error. This is essentially a toss-up.
Yeah, the wheels are turning in my head for a second. I mean, to some degree, the disadvantage to not debating is that people just think that you're scared to debate. There's sort of perception issues that come up. It becomes a talking point for your opponent. I mean, I don't know that you know, the proverbial swing voter in, you know, Delaware County or whatever is sitting around and on their checklist of issues they're thinking about is whether, you know, debate willingness. Is that really going to, like, push them over the edge on one direction towards the other? But yeah, I mean, it can be an opportunity to raise money. You know, you produce a viral clip saying something, or you can, you know, produce a viral clip of your opponent saying something. So there are certainly advantages to the mechanics of doing a debate. But as far as is it a net advantage, given the risk of, you know, whether you're Sherrod Brown giving people a better idea of who Bernie Moreno is, you know, I don't know. I mean, but it's just, it is a tradition, and it's kind of sad to see people not do it. It's kind of, you know, things are so tightly stage managed now that something that gives you, like, the modicum of spontaneity is, you know, just kind of managed out of existence. So it's a real bummer. I mean, there have been Senate debates in all of the key races across the country. It's been a thing in Ohio, even in races that weren't that competitive in the past. And so, yeah, you don't like to see candidates just sort of, like, risk manage their way out of doing something interesting.
Well, and it's a really big shift for Brown especially, and he alluded to this, that he's done this before, and he has. He debated Jim Renacci 3 times, Josh Mandel 3 times. I went back and watched Brown-DeWine debate, which was quite a throwback. But, you know, it's something that he has always made a point to do. So it's interesting that it's not happening this time.
And even though Brown and Moreno aren't debating, that doesn't mean we aren't hearing from them. My television is full of ads. My computer is full of ads. My phone is full of ads. Haley, it's on track to be the most expensive non-presidential contest in history.
Yeah, we're about to outpace Georgia. We may have already by now. I'm not 100% sure, but, you know, it's interesting because Ohio, we all know, is not a battleground state in the presidential race, so we're not getting inundated by those ads. We're not seeing Harris and Trump ads all the time, but we might as well be with the level of advertising that we're seeing from Brown and Moreno and outside groups as well. I mean, it's in the hundreds of millions at this point, and I think people are still going to be throwing money at the wall to see what sticks before Election Day.
I was watching the Ohio State game on Saturday. I didn't see a single political ad.
I saw one for Kamala Harris.
Yeah, right. I saw that one too.
Okay.
But I didn't see one for the Senate race. I was shocked. So yeah. Anyways, they missed the boat there, I guess.
I don't know what market that was on because I was like, why am I seeing a Kamala Harris ad in Ohio?
I think some of those are like national bias.
Yeah, that's what I wondered. So, Marty, the reason this is so expensive is because control of the U.S. Senate is really riding on Ohio. With Joe Manchin retiring and John Tester in trouble in Montana, Democrats seem to be putting all of their eggs into Brown's basket.
They're putting a whole lot of them, that's for sure. And this is because it's about power. If you control the Senate and the White House, and I think the Democrats are looking pretty good to control the House, then the president can pass his or her agenda. And also the Senate, not for nothing, confirms all top-level presidential appointees and Supreme Court justices.
Yeah. So early voting is underway. And Andrew, both Brown and Moreno kicked it off in Franklin County on Tuesday. Why does that matter?
Well, it could just be that, you know, I know that, like, for example, the Franklin County Republican Party had their Lincoln Day dinner on Tuesday night. So there's always these, you know, fun, just kind of logistical explanations for things. But, you know, especially for Brown, Cleveland, you know, maybe I just having worked for an organization there for a long time and kind of, you know, having an affinity for the city, they think they're the center of Ohio. But for Democrats, it really was just for years and years and years. And what we have seen over the last 5 years or so is Franklin County now has more people in it. And as of this year, it appears they have more registered voters, too. And also an increasingly larger share of the Democratic vote share as well. So it just kind of, I think, highlights how Cleveland is a metropolitan area that's losing population. Franklin County and Columbus and Greater Columbus are growing and probably will do so for a long time. And so I just imagine we're going to see more and more electoral strategy kind of explicitly focus around that fact.
I also have found it interesting to watch that, you know, Moreno, he's not spending every waking moment in Franklin County, but he's shown a willingness to play here, even though it is a Democratic county. I mean, he was at the early voting thing. He's held several events before in Franklin County, and he does live here now, which might be part of it. But I was talking to Jim Renacci, and he said one of his regrets from his Senate run was that he didn't campaign enough in the big Democratic stronghold, so maybe that's a consideration for Moreno.
And that's actually a play out of the Sherrod Brown playbook.
I was going to say, yeah, he's been in like Chillicothe and all these other places.
And the idea is to not necessarily win those counties, but keep your opponent's margins down as much as you possibly can.
Yeah, Trump is winning rural parts of the states, or Trump has won in 2016 and 2020, rural parts of Ohio by like 80-20, 70-30, and those used to be 60-40. So if you can bring it back down to 60-40, then you're in a better spot.
And, you know, this might be another reason why Brown, if he is reluctant to debate, might be reluctant to debate, is he's been in places like Chillicothe where people know him. And he's really working hard to separate himself from the national Democratic ticket. And perhaps there's a perception that if he stands on a stage and debates Bernie Moreno and Moreno brings up all these national issues that the Trump campaign is bringing up, that he may see that as not helping him.
Yeah, so much of Brown's strategy is to talk past that stuff. If you're as a reporter, I think we've probably all had the experience of asking him a question and him just kind of giving the same answer as if you hadn't asked that particular question, and doing that on live television.
True of politicians generally sometimes.
Yeah. Well, so doing that on live TV just looks different and looks like you're dodging the question. If
that's
he's dodging
sure.
our questions, nobody cares. But if, you know, if voters actually see that happening on stage with the candidate that they're thinking about voting for, maybe they view it differently.
A new Washington Post poll found that Brown and Moreno are essentially tied. Brown polled at 48%, Moreno at 47%, and 3% had no opinion. I'm always curious about the no opinions at this point, but Haley, these narrowing numbers confirm what we've expected all along. This is going to be a close race.
Yeah, I think all of us do, take polls with a grain of salt, but I think it's very fair to say that these numbers are accurate in the sense that we just don't know what's going to happen on election day. We still have a few weeks to go. You know, it's going to come down to, I think, to what extent Brown can really push his brand and remind Ohioans that he's been around for a while. And then I think for Moreno, it's about reminding folks that he's the Republican, he's the Trump guy. I do think there is some desire among Republicans to hear more about his own story and his background and not just attacking Brown all the time, which has basically been the strategy so far, but we'll see how much of a difference that makes.
Yeah, circling back to what you said, Andrew, that poll looked at where they stand on issues. So Brown leads on handling abortion, healthcare, helping the middle class. Sounds about right for Sherrod Brown. But Moreno was ahead on immigration, taxes, and crime, which are areas maybe Brown does it well. Actually, all summer I saw a lot of like border and fentanyl ads from Sherrod Brown.
Yeah, and actually the New York Times had an illuminating story last week about the focus from Republican Senate candidates on transgender issues. There's been some polling.
Seen a lot of those ads.
Well, it turns out that according to that story, there was not a single ad that the big Republican Senate super PAC aired that didn't mention that issue. So it's essentially been their only focus. But and another interesting thing in polling that you see is that the negative perception for each candidate has gone down up. So, you know, they're viewed more negatively over the course of the last month. And so, you know, these attack ads, I think that voters on some level tune them out. But clearly, you know, something that political practitioners say is that they run negative ads because they work. And we're seeing some evidence of that, you know, in the polling. But it's kind of, you know, because we're talking about tie race, it's kind of they're just trying to pull each other down, you know, basically, even if it's just a little bit, you know, that could be decisive.
Signal also did some polling with other outlets in Northeast Ohio and found voters there are really worried about the economy, Andrew.
Yeah, that was, I mean, it's just the Northeast Ohio region. It kind of expansively, it's 20 counties or so. So it's not just sometimes Cleveland thinks they're Northeast Ohio and that's it. Voters had 8 to 10 choices of issues that they could pick as being their big issue. And 50% said the economy. That's a huge number. It was more than the rest of the issues combined, basically. And so when you get into the nitty gritty of that, you know, the economy can mean different things to different people. But one of the things that I thought was interesting, the top issue in the community that people gave, which was something like 20 to 25%, was grocery prices. And that cut across groups that include people that really are hurt by grocery prices going up, and then those who just kind of like, you know, they're maybe more well off, but it's something that they notice and it's sort of an inconvenience or something like that for them. And so, like I said, the question though is, what does that mean sort of to an individual voter, and what kind of economic issues are they dealing with? And that just that answer different or is different for different types of groups.
Tomorrow marks 1 week of early voting here in Ohio. Marty, turnout looks pretty steady. Nothing out of the ordinary. I think there was like a short power outage in one of the counties, but so far seems so good.
I think so. I think it's hard to draw many conclusions this time around compared to 2020 because of the pandemic.
Totally different environment.
It's a different environment, but both sides will tell you voter intensity is all important. Who can get their voters to the polls, you know, and that's where, now that we're getting close to election day, this is where we're going to see how accurate the public opinion polling is in measuring that.
Yeah, I'm purposely waiting to see how many door knockers I get because I live in Delaware County, which is a swing county. So I'm holding off just to see how many people come to my door.
But so these polls, so the Politico had a story overnight where they had a leaked copy of a memo of one of the other big Republican Senate groups, and it showed Brown up 6, I think, and it showed Trump up 4, which I just don't...
I don't know.
I don't buy it exactly, but you know the reason why I bring it up is that the difference between Trump winning Ohio, which we all expect that he will, but you know, unexpected things may happen, but let's just say things play out how we expect. Trump could win Ohio by 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 points, or he could win by 9, 10, 11, 12 points. And the single digit, especially middle single digit, could give people like Sherrod Brown and other Democrats in competitive races a chance. The higher that number goes, the harder it is for them to kind of exceed the top of the ticket and the kind of headwinds that they face. So that's just that's a thing that I'm very focused on is what does that Trump margin look like, because it could end up making the difference in these other races that we're following.
Early voting hours this week in Franklin County are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Weekend early voting doesn't start until October 26th. And don't forget, if you want an absentee ballot, you have until October 29th to request one. So you've got to get that request in. For more information, you can go to voteohio.gov. Coming up, J.D. Vance continues to get questions about 2020, and Donald Trump apparently has a bit of a tie to First Energy. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Anna Saver. Still with us is Haleen B. Miller, a political reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, Marty Schladen from the Ohio Capital Journal, and Andrew Tobias, a state reporter for Signal. Ohio Senator and vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance ran the talk show circuit this weekend and continued to get questions about who won the 2020 election. We're going to play a clip in just a second. It's a little bit longer than normal. We don't normally play two-minute clips, but I want to preface that I think it's important to hear the full exchange with Martha Raddatz on ABC's Sunday Morning.
In interview after interview, question after question, and in the debate, you refuse to say that Donald Trump lost the 2020 election. So I'm just going to assume that if I ask you 50 times whether he lost the election, you would not acknowledge that he did. Is that correct?
Martha, you asked this question. I've been asked this question 10 times in the past couple of weeks. Of course, Donald Trump and I believe there were problems in 2020. You haven't asked about inflation.
I'm sorry. Let's stick to this. I know.
American people want us to talk about how to make their lives better. They don't want us to
say that.
Because, Martha, I believe that in 2020, when big tech firms were censoring American citizens, that created very serious problems. And by the way, Martha, you're a journalist. You represent the American media. Look at the polling on this. A lot of Americans feel like they were silenced in the run-up to the 2020 election. That is such a bigger issue. That fundamental problem than me and Donald Trump talking about it. And unfortunately,
but
Martha,
I don't understand why you won't just say
Kamala
it if
Harris,
you believe it.
She's... won't just say what? That I think the 2020 election had some problems? I've said that repeatedly.
Did Donald Trump lose? That's the question, and you know that's the question.
Martha, I've said repeatedly I think the 2020 election had problems. You want to say rigged? You want to say he won? Use whatever vocabulary term you want. I want to focus on the fact that we had big technology firms censoring our fellow citizens in a way that violated our fundamental rights. The fact that you're so obsessed with what word I use to describe this phenomenon rather than the phenomenon itself suggests something very broken in the American media. If we want to restore trust in American elections and democracy, which I want to do, Martha, we have to talk openly about what happened in 2020. And most importantly, we've got to talk about what happened afterwards. Okay. Americans being unable to afford the basic necessities of middle-class life because Kamala Harris is in the White House.
We're going to leave right there. Appreciate your time this morning.
Marty, this should be a pretty simple question. Who won the 2020 election? But I get the sense Vance is not going to answer it.
No, and it was kind of ironic that he said we need to speak openly about this, as he was very strongly refusing to speak openly about it. You know, more than 60 courts have rejected what little evidence was provided of a rigged election. Trump's own attorney general told him that there was no fraud that would change the outcome of that election. He was told over and over. They all know that Donald Trump lost in 2020. And it's a little painful to listen to J.D. Vance so persistently try to just not acknowledge that reality.
Martha Raddatz also pushed back during that interview on how the Trump campaign describes FEMA's reaction to the flooding in North Carolina and the way they talk about gang violence in Colorado. Haley, the 13-minute interview with ABC seemed to be a debate about reality. And I get the sense that this is what the whole election is about. What reality do voters think they're living in?
Right. I mean, are Haitian migrants eating people's pets? No. But that is a thing that is out there now. And we saw, of course, a lot of misinformation in 2020, especially in the throes of the COVID pandemic. And I think, unfortunately, this is just a part of politics now, is, you know, you have candidates out there presenting their worldview, and sometimes that worldview is not a view that's based in reality.
Yeah, I don't know. It's, Andrew, I don't know what to make of it. It seems like such a fundamentally simple question. Who won 2020's election?
Yeah, we were talking earlier about candidates not wanting to answer a question, and there's sort of, you know, an art of doing that and sort of seeing it play out, you know, in real time. And so, yeah, I mean, clearly the interviewer there was trying to not just let him spin out, but really like make him cling to not answering the question. You know, so yeah, he was saying that there were there was the story about Hunter Biden's laptop that some of the social media platforms, you know, suppressed. Some people think that had the story run that maybe it would have made the difference in the election. Maybe that was, you know, key to some people. But in 2016, you know, there's the story about Hillary Clinton's server that, you know, had James Comey not announced that there were no criminal charges or from it, that whatever happened then, maybe the election would have turned out differently then too. Like, there's always these sort of counterfactuals that you can't really know what happened. But, you know, the fact is that Trump had the chance to make the case to support his claims, not that some story getting reported, you know, one way or the other. You know, it wasn't that. He said that the election was stolen from him and that there were, you know, these conspiratorial elements that took place. You know, people have rejected that. Trump's campaign officials, when speaking under oath, have rejected that. But it's something that, by the way, I'll say that Vance's talking point that the media, you know, is obsessed with this, Trump mentions it all the time during his events. and then that prompts more questions. So, but yeah, it's an untenable place that people like J.D. Vance have been placed to have to, you know, to try to take the position that they have.
I just want to close the circle and make the obvious point about how ominous this is for our democracy. The whole system is founded on the fact that we have elections and people respect the outcomes. I mean, it's a much less significant realm, but what if you had a football league where after a team lost, they spent the whole next week complaining about the officiating and, you know, all this other stuff and delegitimized the outcome. But in democracy, it's much more important. I know most people know that, but it bears repeating.
Yeah, and I remember in the 2020 election, I think the issue was that Franklin County sent the wrong ballots to some people. They mixed up Dublin and Worthington or something like that. And at the time, Donald Trump was pushing that on national national social media, saying this shows how elections are messed up. He's kind of priming people to see that. And it's very clearly, you know, you see them laying the groundwork this time, too, to do that kind of thing. And ultimately, you know, like, I mean, I'm not going to repeat what I said before, but we saw that they've had the chance to make their case and it fell flat. But also, it's you can see that's very clearly a strategy.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not like we haven't had contested elections before. Like, I remember 2000, Bush v. Gore. And I say Bush v. Gore because it was a literal U.S. Supreme Court case that ultimately decided whether to continue the recount in Florida, gave George Bush the election. I mean, that was primed with arguably more questions about the legitimacy than we saw in 2020.
Oh, yeah. It came down to 500 and some votes in Florida. And a lot of people are highly critical of
We learned a lot about hanging chads.
Yeah, and a lot of other stuff. But once the Supreme Court ruled, and a lot of people have problems with that ruling, but Al Gore conceded the election, you know, for the good of the country, which is no great act of patriotism. It's doing his duty.
Well, let's hope that because we don't have the pandemic hanging over things this time, that there won't be these kinds of questions. Because, you know, it was a weird environment to be trying to do something like that in. So you might, you know, maybe just being less weird when it comes to there not being a global pandemic going on, maybe things will be smoother this time. We'll see.
Let's hope so. First Energy is back in the news, this time for what it spent courting Donald Trump. The company became infamous here in Ohio when the FBI arrested former Speaker Larry Householder in 2020. First Energy admitted to bribing Householder into passing a billion-dollar bailout for its two nuclear power plants. Householder was convicted. He is now serving a 20-year prison sentence. So, Marty, new documents make it look like the company tried to get a federal bailout from then-President Donald Trump.
Yes, and that part is not new. A lot of that was laid out in the evidence at Larry Householder's criminal trial. But Dave Anderson at the Energy and Policy Institute took a deep dive into documents and really filled in some of the gaps. First Energy was overinvested in nuclear and coal generation. Fracking came along so that natural gas was a lot cheaper. Renewables were getting a lot cheaper. So they made a bad bet, and now they needed a bailout. And so they worked along federal and state lines to get one. And as they worked along those federal lines, they courted the Trump administration with dark money and patronizing Donald Trump's businesses.
Yeah, it's a First Energy CEO Chuck Jones, he's now facing state criminal charges, met with Trump at Trump Tower in July of 2016. He appeared at a Canton fundraiser. So, I mean, it sounds like they were trying anything and everything, Andrew, to find a bailout or someone who would be willing to help them out.
Yeah, and what I've said about this general story is that there is the criminal side of it, and on some level, there's, you know, debate about where is the line in that case between kind of like politics that people in America don't like, but it's not necessarily legal, versus actual criminal conspiracy and bribery and things like that, and that's a gray area, but clearly a jury convicted people involved with that case. But then also, kind of more broadly, the fact that there's been these investigations, that all of these internal corporate records have been pushed out into the public eye, that we see things that we don't normally get a chance to actually see, it shows just the extent to which, you know, deep-pocketed special interests can try to influence public officials and the kinds of things that they do, and including, like Marty was saying, you know, spending money at the Trump Hotel, buying $25 cocktails that I'm sure taste great. You know? but yeah, it's just, for me, like, it's kind of old news, but on the other hand, it's just a remarkable way to actually pull the curtain back to see how this stuff happens.
And the Trump administration did take specific steps to try to help them get out of their difficulty until the public perception that this is a bailout became too big, and then they backed away, and then Energy Secretary Rick Perry said, it's up to you states, you figure out.
Yeah, the irony is that, you know, the Biden administration basically also took like a pro-nuclear stance. So it's who knows whether this stuff actually makes a difference, but they wouldn't be doing it if they didn't think it didn't matter.
Foreign nationals are now banned from donating to ballot campaigns here in Ohio. At least that's what an appellate court ruled last week in a 2-1 vote. Haley, this has been months of back and forth legal wrangling over whether this law passed by Republicans in Ohio violate the First Amendment rights of green card holders to donate to campaigns.
Yeah, I was a little surprised by the appellate court decision. Not that I'm a judge or an attorney, but, you know, the initial federal court that this was in was pretty emphatic that you cannot limit the rights of green card holders to donate to campaigns. They are legitimate citizens, but the appellate court disagreed, you know, saying that the state has a vested interest in prohibiting all foreign nationals from donating to campaigns. So it was, I imagine, a nice I told you so moment for the Republicans back in May who were debating this. And it's interesting because I think there were, you know, some Democrats who obviously did not support the legislation but figured it was going to get tossed out in court. And there were a couple Republican lawmakers who warned that the green card holder aspect of this was a step too far. But at least for now, that's where we are. If this gets appealed again, I don't know. But
yeah, I was going to say, Marty, I think we'll probably see an appeal in this case, and then it'll just keep working its way on up.
There could be a request for the entire Sixth Circuit to hear en banc. Yeah. and I think that we haven't heard the last of this issue. There are a lot of complications that arise, you know, because there are a lot of organizations who engage in political speech. And now they're going to have to scour all of their donors and check their citizenship status. This is also at variance with the federal law, which allows green card holders to make political contributions.
And it's worth reminding folks why the legislature was so gung-ho on this. They frequently point to this group, the 1630 Fund, that at one point in its existence received a donation from a Swiss billionaire. The 1630 Fund has donated to a lot of progressive causes, including the Abortion Rights Amendment last year. But with these dark money groups, I mean, the money gets like thrown into a pot and then you just like don't know what happens from there. So like, did the Swiss billionaire's money go to something in Massachusetts or Ohio or Texas? Like, it's just really hard to track this stuff. So it's a difficult argument to sort of wrap your head around.
That's a really good point. You know, the dark money rose as a consequence of Citizens United. And so, you know, which is it going to be that we have all of this undisclosed money in our politics, but none of it can be from a non-citizen? You know, how is that supposed to work?
It was also some of that money flowed into this year's issue one, which is all about redistricting and how to end gerrymandering. And that's a good segue because, Andrew, a new Bowling Green State University poll shows 60% of Ohioans plan to vote yes. That's a number that's awfully similar to how Ohioans voted on the two issue ones last year. But I wonder, Andrew, does the way this question was asked give you any pause?
Yeah, that's the case for me with almost any ballot issue. I'd say an exception, and maybe the only exception, but perhaps there are other like this, is the abortion question last year. Because in that case, you know, unlike so often what happens with ballot issues is that it's people who are thinking about voting or thinking about who they want to vote for president or, you know, something else entirely. It is not the issue that's going to be put in front of them. And so that can make somebody because they are. So I'm sorry, I'm kind of getting off my train of thought. So with abortion, people know exactly what they think about that.
Oh,
you know, it's very clear. You know, that was something that we kind of saw play out over the years after Roe v. Wade was overturned. But with some other issue, people might be more persuadable because it's just not something they spend a lot of time thinking about. And so with this redistricting measure, the question is, what are voters going to be thinking that they're voting on? Are they going to understand exactly what it's going to do? And so with that poll, the pollsters laid out a pretty detailed description of what the measure would do, but that description varies widely from the ballot language that a lot of voters are going to be looking at. So just the question is, besides the fact that even when we know it's either Donald Trump or Kamala Harris, and those polls can be wildly inaccurate, or at least, you know, significantly so, take that out of it. You know, when you get down to like, what do you actually think you're voting on? That question is really fundamental, and it's unclear. So it's hard for me to see that it has 60% support. That doesn't seem to be, you know, from my conversations with people involved with it, that I don't think that's what they think it is. But I don't know, maybe it is too. So who knows?
Well, and didn't the Bowling Green poll just ask people if they support or oppose gerrymandering?
That was a different poll, actually. The Baldwin-Wallace.
Oh, that was Baldwin-Wallace, sorry.
And then, you know, in that case, it's like, which one's the gerrymandering, you know, vote?
That's what I think is the heart of it. Because when you see the ballot language, it says that issue one, the amendment we're voting on, will mandate gerrymandering. Now, the supporters of issue one say that's factually inaccurate, that conservatives on the ballot board put that language in to tank it. But Marty, my real question is if you don't know a lot about this, right? And both yes and no signs that I've seen everywhere say end gerrymandering, vote yes or vote no. I wonder if you're going in and you see that language, is it confusing enough that it's going to tank this effort?
I wonder, because you know, I've already voted, and it's a lot of language to stand there in the ballot in the voting booth and read. I wonder whether there aren't just going to be a lot of people who don't vote that far down their ballots and
the undervote. Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, 60% seems like an awful lot to me as well. But
yeah, it was like 60-20. It's the, you know, it's yeah, whatever the wide margin was. It's not just the 60%, but that's part of it. Yeah,
that seems awfully high to me. But there is this coalition that was built through the two issue ones last year that both won resoundingly. And that coalition still exists, I think. And those are the people who've already been educated when they walk into the voting booth. And so I wonder, we're going to see. That's a big question I have on Election Day. If issue one passes pretty well, maybe the margins in Ohio are going to be on the lower range that Andrew spoke of before.
Yeah, and the counterpoint to what I said before is that the August vote last year, that sort of would have made it, basically it would have blocked the abortion rights measure from passing had voters approved it. That was kind of an esoteric issue, and voters understood that. The vote percentage was very close to the November vote, and so you saw signs that voters made that connection. So the question is, will that happen this time?
Yeah, and both of those were off-year elections, so I do think there's a lot of, how do I say this delicately, low-information voters that are going to come out this year that wouldn't have come out in 23.
It's just more like normal people who don't sit around and think about politics like we do.
That's fair. They probably have better things going on in their lives. Coming up, what else Ohioans had to say in that Baldwin-Wallace poll? That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Still with us is Haley B. Miller, political reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, Marty Schladen of the Ohio Capital Journal, and Andrew Tobias of Signal. Before we break, we were talking about a new poll from Bowling Green State University. It showed a larger-than-usual lead for Senator Sherrod Brown. It had him up 49-44% over Bernie Moreno. Haley, I'm not entirely sure that's accurate, but, I mean, these are all within the margin of error. So, I mean, it could be the opposite given the margin of error.
Yeah, I mean, that just takes me back to, like, I think this race is tied, you know? Because even, the numbers fluctuate, but the commonality is that they're all within the margin of error. So I just don't think...
That's the takeaway.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, I just think it's time for our weekly reminder that polls have... They're not science. They're kind of social science. There's a lot of unknowns there. Are they reaching voters in a representative sample? Are there weighting techniques to correct for that? So, you know, one poll is one poll.
Yeah. Two data points that caught my eye, though, were how people felt about the economy and former President Donald Trump. So 59% of Ohioans said the economy is getting worse. Only 23% said we were headed in the right direction, which makes sense for a state Trump is winning, right? We're on the wrong path. We need the new guy in. But 49% of Ohioans have an unfavorable view of Trump. And Andrew, to me, that says there's a decent number of Ohioans who don't like Trump, but plan to vote for him anyway.
Yeah, polling kind of reflects that. I mean, Biden, so Joe Biden's not running for re-election, so it's kind of not the right thing to look at, although maybe it is in the sense that people tie Harris to Biden, then it doesn't matter. But what the polling has shown in the past is that people dislike Biden more, particularly, you know, his approval ratings, fell off a lot about 2 years ago and never recovered. So that's not that's not inconsistent with what we kind of see. There's some polls that have shown Trump, you know, like it's a net. So they call it a net plus two favorability, but it's because it's like 49% favorable, 47% unfavorable. But yeah, there's definitely a segment of voters, and this shows up in a lot of different questions, that vote for Donald Trump, but that don't particularly like him that much. And so this is just one of the ways that you see that kind of manifest itself. But it's, you know, we had a, I wrote about a poll that a group commissioned. So this group, we don't know who's funding them, but they're called the Democracy Defense Initiative. And they kind of purport to try to make sure that, to the point, the conversation we're having earlier about do voters trust the result, they're kind of trying to prime voters to be trusting of the election system. And they asked, do you worry that the candidates are not going to acknowledge a loss? And it was basically a partisan answer where, you know, the one side would say the other one isn't going to acknowledge if they lose or not. But then there was a slice of like 25% of Republican voters said they think that Trump would say he won even if he lost. So, and if you just think about that, that's congruent with I vote for Trump, but don't particularly like him. So that's yeah. It's just interesting. And so, like, yeah, we're talking about polling is squishy. It can be really hard to try to predict stuff off of it, but you can get a feel for public sentiment and what different types of voters are feeling. And that's one of the things that you see.
Yeah. One thing that Ohioans don't seem to believe, at least according to polling lately, there's so much polling lately. Oh my goodness. Must be an election year. But one thing Ohioans don't seem to believe is Trump's debunked claims about Haitian immigrants in Springfield, Haley. It's, I think, only like 25% of Ohioans think there's some truth to those claims.
Yeah. Which is not zero. So that's unfortunate. But I think a lot of people sort of recognize that that was an extreme claim that was made. I forget what the exact numbers were. It is a little bit different when you look at it by party affiliation. Democrats overwhelmingly do not believe those claims. Some Republicans did. But I mean, there's just been so much said about this at this point. And I think what also helps is that you have Governor Mike DeWine, who is a Republican, saying this stuff, we don't have any evidence of this, you know, this is just harming the community. So, you know, it's a tale of two Republicans, as always, with DeWine and Trump. But, you know, when it comes to this, I think, you know, people were willing to hear what their governor had to say about it.
DeWine is like the only statewide politician with positive approval numbers, I think.
I think that might be true. And I wonder,
he's also not running for re-election right now, though.
Oh, and that's the golden place for any politician to be. But I wonder, and we're going to see, whether there's a political price to pay for telling people bald-faced lies that people know are bald-faced lies. And I wonder, back to issue one, whether that's going to tell on that election, too, where you know, they're claiming that issue one is the side of gerrymandering when the Ohio legislature is gerrymandered by any objective standard. And voting against issue one would protect the status quo, you know, and some other misrepresentations were made with last year's issues one. And my whole point is just, I wonder whether at a certain point people are like, OK, I don't believe anything that comes out of your mouth, you know, and so I'm going to vote against you. And we'll see.
One thing we won't be voting on this November is whether to raise the minimum wage. The group gathering signatures to bring us up to $15 an hour fell short of the signatures they needed for 2024. But, Marty, they're looking at 2025, so, you know, never-ending statewide elections.
That's right. And the polling I've seen, I know it's not very substantial, but raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour is pretty popular. I think I remember from last year a poll that had it at 60%. So I think it's likely to happen. I think that it didn't happen this year strictly because of you know, logistical problems. It's really hard to get something on the ballot.
Yeah, if I'm Sherrod Brown, I would have wanted this on the ballot this year, but the campaign was not the most organized. And
they weren't using paid petition signature gatherers, which it is very hard to do, to collect all the signatures from all the counties with volunteers.
Right.
Andrew, there's another constitutional amendment in the works, this one about public works projects. So it's called the State Capital Improvement Program, and we're going to ask to borrow $2.5 billion over the next 10 years to build stuff.
Yeah, I haven't looked at that issue carefully, so I, you know, I'm not an expert on it by any means, but there is an infrastructure program in Ohio that, because the Ohio Constitution sets the amount that the state can borrow at $500,000, which was a lot of money back when the Constitution was approved in 1851. I'm sure that sounded like a bazillion dollars to the Whig Republican and the Whig lawmakers that would have put that up. Actually, I think it was a Democrat, something I said out loud. But anyways, so any kind of borrowing that exceeds that must be approved by the voters. And so this particular program dates back to the 1980s. It's been approved and renewed several times, but it's up for, it's expiring. And so next year is when the 10-year will run out. And so essentially they'll get one shot at this. I mean, I don't know what happens if
It fails.
So let's say they put it up for May and it fails and the money runs out in July. Does that mean that, you know, like your roads are not just going to be closed, you know? No, but there probably is going to be some projects that will create a funding lapse for it. You know, lawmakers actually made it really hard to have August special elections. So they might have to try again in November. But anyways, that's something that they're going to potentially be up against the wall to get that approved. But the vote hasn't happened yet. But last week, a couple of lawmakers basically who are definitely close to like the leadership kind of consensus to the extent that exists in the House, you know, but people with some gravitas were saying we need to talk about this. And, you know, so this is going to get the ball rolling to putting this on the May ballot, I imagine.
Hard to have special elections in August, but not impossible, as we learned.
Yes.
That's true.
And my understanding of this fund, it's really important to small towns. I've worked for small town newspapers. There's little communities like Gloucester, Ohio. They might have an infrastructure need that they just don't have the tax base to handle. You know, maybe it's just sewer project, something like that. So this is real stuff.
Yeah. This just happened, so I'm not going to ask you guys to comment on it, but I thought it was worth noting for listeners that former Columbus Zoo CEO Tom Stolf has been sentenced to 7 years in prison for his role in the theft of $2.29 million from the zoo. He pleaded guilty a couple months ago, and now he's been sentenced to 7 years in prison. If you're looking for more information, you can go online to WOSU.org. We have a story up already. Marty, let's talk about pharmacy benefit managers.
Oh, goody.
We have just a couple of minutes left, but Sherrod Brown of Ohio and Ron Wyden of Oregon want the Federal Trade Commission to open a separate investigation into agreements between large drug makers and these middlemen who are supposed to work to get us lower prices.
Yes. These middlemen are huge companies in and of themselves. They facilitate drug transactions on behalf of insurers. But each of these three companies, they represent about 80% of all insured people in the United States. They're part of much larger conglomerates. We're talking UnitedHealth, CVS, and Cigna Express Scripts. And they're getting into more and more parts of the healthcare chain. Optum, part of UnitedHealth, owns more doctor's offices than anybody else in the United States now. And they're all doing these things. Well, now, Express Scripts, the thing that Brown and Wyden have a problem with is Express Scripts and CVS are entering into co-manufacturing agreements with manufacturers. And already these pharmacy benefit managers negotiate huge rebates from these manufacturers, which many say is raising the list prices of drugs, but they say they use that size to get these discounts from these drug makers. Well, now they're becoming the drug makers, so they're going to be on both sides of that transaction, and that's the concern.
So the relationship has gotten too close for comfort, at least for Brown and Wyden.
Too big. Too much what they call vertical integration. You know, if you
Well, that's what broke up Standard Oil, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And ironically, there are people, because CVS's retail wing is struggling right now, they're doing layoffs, there are people saying that CVS has just gotten too big and they need to break themselves up.
Andrew, you talked with Secretary of State Frank LaRose about his political future. He came in third in the three-way race for U.S. Senate in March of this year. I'm losing sense of time. He is Secretary of State until 2026. What does Frank LaRose want to do next?
Well, yeah, I talked to him about this, and the first thing he said was that he doesn't, you know, like, believe in the idea of looking towards the next thing before you finish the thing that's in front of you. Now, that being
said, but he ran for U.S. Senate while Secretary of State.
Yeah, every politician does exactly what I just described. But, you know, like, to in fairness to LaRose, you know, like he doesn't you don't want to be so focused on the next thing that you lose focus on what you're doing. So there's something to be said for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, he lost the Senate race in March. I think that was like the thing that he's been aspiring to for a long time. You know, all of these elected officials often imagine themselves as, you know, nobody, no 6-year-old boy like kind of wakes up in the morning and says, I want to be state auditor someday. You know, like they all want to be president and or maybe a U.S. senator or something like that. So what he said was that he needs to figure out what he's doing next, including finishing the election that we're currently doing. But he mentioned possibly running for state auditor. He also mentioned hoping that Mike DeWine might appoint him to the U.S. Senate. And he also mentioned
if Vance becomes VP.
Yes. Or maybe being state, or maybe getting a job in the Trump administration. So we'll see.
That was Andrew Tobias, state reporter for Signal. Thank you so much.
Sure.
And thank you to Marty Schladen of the Ohio Capital Journal.
Thank you, Anna.
And last but certainly not least, thanks to Haley B. Miller, political reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau.
Good to be here.
Thank you all for listening to All Sides right here on 89.7 NPR News.